Welcome to The Colorcast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. I'm Jason Myris, a colorist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist in New York City.
And I'm Josh Petock, a colorist in Los Angeles. And it's that time of year again. It's NAB time, so we're going to do a full rundown of all of our hopes, dreams, wishes, all of that stuff for what's coming up for the next NAB.
Fears.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's shut up and take my money time, right, Juan? So what are you guys excited about? What are you guys thinking that will be really cool and interesting?
I mean, I think the obvious thing every year is you have to wonder what Blackmagic is going to come out with. We're always very surprised by whatever they come out with. 2013, Pocket Cinema Camera. 2014, the Ursa. And I mean, even in the middle, we had a big development with Fusion as well.
Oh, right.
So,
yeah.
So we'll see.
Around IBC time.
Yeah. So we'll see what ends up coming from that.
I'm sure a lot of things will focus around. To me, there's three big things. First is, you know, will there be Resolve 12? And, you know, maybe there's a very good chance for that. The other big one would be, will they introduce new cameras or maybe go and offer upgrades for cameras like the Ursa that have the upgradable sensor modules? It'd be fun to see that idea play out. I think people would be really excited about that because there aren't lots and lots of cameras that necessarily do that. So that'd be an interesting concept. And from there, Fusion. Is Fusion, now that it's part of sort of the Blackmagic family, is there going to be something good that they've been able to accomplish in the time since it's been out?
Yeah. Do you guys think that they can make some of those compositing tools available in Resolve? Or do you think, I know that's a kind of fundamental, should we be doing this in the grading system? But I'm sure a lot of people have thought that that might be an option.
Well, I think if you look at the kind of the bigger trends with grading in general, like even within Resolve and Baselight and with systems like Luster, you know, you end up with a lot of integration with compositing. How do we bring mats in? How do we start doing some basic compositing in the actual application? You know, you can do kind of clone operations inside of Resolve already. You can sort of see the trend lines in the industry as a whole where those two things are kind of like becoming more and more overlapped. That Venn diagram of what's color and what's VFX has that overlapping area is getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah. And that's the thing that's been like a really interesting, you know, debate is, you know, a lot of people are trying to figure out, not necessarily if you do it at all, but really where the line is, you know, like where the fair point of separation between, you know, send it out or keep it in the color bay. You know,
sure.
I think a lot of people agree, hey, yeah, it'd be awesome to be able to do a quick paint out. And then other people would love to be able to do more. You know, they want to be doing sky replacements on the fly. And so a lot of people also are scared, and is a really good concept around the idea of be really good at a specific thing versus be sort of ordinary at many things. And so that's always a problem.
Well, I think in terms of strategy, like what you want to do is not ever have your clients feel like you're not maximizing their time and their value, right? So it's really about kind of triage and figuring out like, well, where's my skill set and what can I do quickly and effectively and what's better done by somebody else who's going to do it more quickly and more effectively than I will. And I think that line is always kind of moving too. You know, things get easier to do when the techniques get developed or a good plugin comes along and does something very quickly. You know, sky replacement becomes a one-click operation with a well-engineered, well-written plugin, then all of a sudden sky replacement is going to be like an everyday thing in the color bay.
Yeah, and now you have that collaborative interface too. So if you really wanted to, you could have an effects artist in another room working away at the sky replacement while you're actually coloring, and then you click on something, everything gets integrated. Would be kind of awesome.
Sure. And in fact, I mean, those workflows are already in place today. Like we do stuff where, you know, I'll work on a shot, set a look, and then have somebody else kind of do the more detailed like rotoing or like tracking or shape building, and then come back and finesse the shot and finish it off there. So that stuff's happening even now.
You know what the other thing too that's really interesting is maybe if we look back on past NAB announcements, a lot of people wish for things, and I think the wishing can be wide and varied, but then what people actually use is really specific. So for instance, a popular thing in the past was say OFX plugin support. Then there's things like being able to break out RGB or HSL, HSV in the node tree. Do you find that, you know, people are regularly using like lab color, you know, in order to grade all the time because now it's available? Or really, is it same as, you know?
I'm glad that you brought up the whole OFX thing, because it's one of those things where be careful what you wish for, because, you know, we all got it, and then it's integrated. However, nothing runs real time, and we're really used to working in Resolve in real time. So, I mean, what would be amazing is if they said, oh yeah, we're offloading all of the OFX stuff to the GPU. Now, I know that that's an insanely complicated idea for any of the plugin manufacturers to deal with, so I'm not making light of any of that, that it's just, oh, let's just flip the switch and now it's rendering on the GPU, because I know specific effects need to be done either on the CPU or the GPU. But I know that just disk caching it is kind of not enough for that stuff.
So there's a little bit of a cart before the horse issue there, or like a parallel work issue there, where it's not just the host developers that need to enable that kind of support, but it's also the plugin needs to be written to support it. And then also the OFX standard, it's sort of, there are small differences between different host implementations that cause issues. That's why you see there's a slightly different version of the OFX plugin for Scratch versus the OFX version that would run on Nuke versus the OFX version that might run on Resolve. And those are just engineering differences to make the host application behave correctly. So it's kind of tricky. I mean, I don't envy the job of the developers of trying to like keep up with all the changes that the host application manufacturers are making.
Yeah, when Resolve, you know, was sort of on its own there for a while, I think, you know, Blackmagic enjoyed a situation where they had their own sandbox and they were able to kind of plan what they wanted to do and implement it. They've shown with all the updates they come out with that they're a really efficient development team. Mm-hmm. And then I'm sure, you know, they wanted to, you know, give everybody certain things like OFX or other sorts of, you know, third-party support on things, you know, and I can just imagine that meeting. They're like, okay, guys, we're going to do it. We're letting people into the sandbox. And the guys are like, oh, you know, because now they have to coordinate these other people. You know, you can just imagine that, you know, they had a really efficient thing going. And then, you know, it comes about time for, you know, participation with other parties. Yeah. You know, and you have to deal with their process.
You saw those growing pains too, because then they were like, well, how do we output an alpha from our OFX plugin? How do we add another layer into this? And sure. So a lot of those things slowly, which is great, it like you could really see that the plugin developers and Blackmagic were working together to unify that whole experience, which was amazing, which mm-hmm. I wish other developers might try to do that. Avid. So.
Well, Avid has a more of a walled garden, right? They literally write their own API for their own plugin infrastructure. And the problem is that it's just really kind of archaic, but it does a lot of powerful stuff.
Yeah.
There's some cool things happening with, I mean, like the Baselite plugin does insane things on,
yes.
on Avid. And performance, that's pretty remarkable.
So speaking of that, what do you guys think? It's going to be a big talk at the show. Like Avid last year was sort of, I guess there were hardcore Avid fans, but to a lot of people, they were sort of becoming, you know, also RANs. And now they'll be, I hope, you know, front and center again in a really nice way that they're supporting 4K and they've got DNX HR. I think they'll be really preeminent company again now.
That brings up an important thing, which is I think this year, more so than in previous years, we've got so many things that have already been announced ahead of NAB that are really kind of impressive things. You know, Alexa Mini is a huge thing for production. It's enormous. And it's scared the pants off Red. And they've already said they're going to announce Weapon, whatever that is. So they're already teasing stuff for NAB. And we already know about the Blackmagic Fusion acquisition and their new pricing. And we already know about Avid doing 4K. And we already know HDR is sort of the next big thing.
Yeah.
There's so many things that we already kind of know. It's going to be hard to imagine what the... my favorite thing about NAB is always what the big unexpected surprise was. You know, I think last year, for me at least, it was that, you know, AJA got into the camera game. And they haven't really made a splash with their coin or Xeon or whatever it's called.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that you would think that they would have similar advantages in that, you know, the 4K recording, you know, their ability to sort of work well on set already with a lot of the hardware they have, just sort of translating that to a more complete camera. And it's weird. I think one of the things is that I look at AJA as being a really talented company. And you can see, even when you're a talented company and you've got a lot of previous experience on set and you've got a lot of the technology required, it's still just really hard. It's, I think building a camera could be on par with, like they say, you know, starting a car company. You know, you think it's easy and you have great ideas and then you go and do it and then all of a sudden, you know, the work begins and it's not a simple task.
Sure.
Yeah. So do you think that there's any new hardware that we're going to expect in the color realm, like panels or everybody I know is dreaming of a Black Magic inexpensive panel. I don't really see that happening.
I don't think the panel game is a high margin game. Like, I think the place where you're seeing new panels is in the low end of the field. Like, you know, the Elements came out and kind of made a big splash and have really kind of taken off in the last, 4 years they've been out. They've become like the dominant third party panel, and they're used really, really effectively in like Luster and with Scratch and now with Mystica. So I think, and who else? Somebody else recently got Element support, didn't they? Filmmaster had Element support in Dakota.
Yes, they did. Yeah, good call. And then, you have SpeedGrade as well. SpeedGrade has, so there's a number of companies for
established,
sure.
Well-established Element support. So, and then Flame even uses Elements, right? Yeah. So I just don't see the kind of the numbers or the trends suggesting that we're going to see another big panel. I think if we see panels, it's going to be budget panels that are, like the oxygen
right? Tech, yeah,
that kind of stuff start to trickle maybe, but there's a certain point where it's just like very kind of diminishing returns on those things. I think that oxygen is really kind of as low as you can possibly get in terms of cost for something that has the very bare minimum function you would need from a set of panels. I just don't see a lot of room for anything. You've got between the oxygen, then you've got the artist color or the tangent wave. Then you've got, the Elements probably, and then you've got, the real big daddy panels. You've kind of fit every niche in that structure. I don't think there's a lot of room for like another panel sets.
Yeah. I think what will happen is until some sort of new controller paradigm comes out, like let's say people find color grading with, like what we'll call like the 3D interface. Have you ever seen, the infrared controllers?
Leap controllers.
Like that, where that's honestly useful. Or it could be a gimmick and everybody buy it and then, it'd sit in a closet. But either way, it'll take something like that beyond the knob and the trackball,
I use that X keys all the time. I think it's great. Sure. It's added a lot of functionality in for me too. I mean, and little inexpensive things like that, maybe that's the new thing.
Yeah, no, I could totally see the Leap as that kind of device, like three-dimensional input device being really interesting for color, where you're able to, because color, really, even if you're dealing with like lift gamma gain, you're really dealing with multi-dimensional adjustment that you're making. You're adjusting RGB levels, but you're also adjusting luminance levels, and you're also splitting that RGB level among multiple tiers. So, I mean, I could see an interface where, for example, you move left to right and you go from low, mids to highs, and maybe you move, X axis and you're affecting the RGB balance, and your Y axis and you're affecting the intensity, and Z axis and you're affecting the luminance or
so
whatever.
I mean, color grading with a Kinect is like what you're going for.
Kinda. Yeah. I mean, I think it could be really interesting. Like,
Or the Oculus Rift.
Or whatever we minus the minus the or Minority Report.
It'd be more like color grading with a theremin.
I mean, that's just one off the cuff iteration of it. But I think there's a value in kind of exploring that idea. I think that to me is much more interesting. And that's a free idea for any manufacturer that wants to get into the game.
Yeah, one just needs a beer one night. Take the idea and run with it though.
Just give me one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things that will be really interesting too is, everybody keeps on liking to label upcoming NABs as the year of. And so we've had, I think this is our third year of 4K. Do you guys think that 4K?
It's the decade of 4K is what we're in.
Do you guys think that 4K will actually come about as being a practical reality now? Or we got one more year of sort of looking at it and wondering whether we want to pay?
Well, actually would be interesting is if somebody comes out with I'm only speaking from the world that I operate in is something that's a more efficient version of a 4K so that you don't have to burn as much drive space.
Well, XAVC is pretty freaking space efficient.
Yeah. And then H265, just for what it's worth on that front, maybe that'll help.
That's true.
In various areas, we'll all be editing H265 from some new DSLR or mirrorless or something.
Yeah.
There actually is, I think the Samsung NX does that.
Or GoPro 5 or whatever.
Yeah. It'll be 4K GoPro hell. It'll be high res cyan skies.
GoPro's heading beyond 4K pretty rapidly. Like they're with every iteration, they keep, you know, pumping up the frame rates, pumping up the resolution faster and more aggressively than the big
boy
cameras.
Kind of died out, luckily, is that we haven't heard a lot about a high FPS.
That's true.
Oh, HFR? Yeah, no, I mean, we haven't heard a lot about 3D. You know, 3D.
Yeah.
Remember 3D? I don't know. Remember HFR?
Remember me, guys? Not really. 3D?
Well, you know what the amazing thing is? I think the thing that's happened, at least on the big feature film level, is that people have stopped shooting for 3D, and the companies that are really making out are the conversion companies. You know, they're taking the 2D edit and they're carving it up, you know?
Yeah.
And so that has taken, you know, a large portion of what we'll call the market that happens before post and sort of nullified the impetus on 3D. But it's still the moneymaker, you know, for big movies. So
it is and it isn't, because I think the number of 3D releases are not going up, they're going down, aren't they?
No, but totally. I just think that you've got this thing, you've got your major 2D release, then you've got your IMAX version, and you've got, for a lot of tent poles at least, a 3D version.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, and that's at least become semi-embedded. And, you know, it could go away, but for right now, I think it feels like, at least at that level.
Yeah, no, because the cost is not tremendous. And
because
you
of conversion, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a bolt-on. You know, it's like you get the rims package on your car.
Sure. And right. I mean, I know of a couple of shows that they decided, like, within 6 weeks of release to decide to make a 3D version. They were like, well, let's do a 3D.
Yeah, let's.
Yeah. And then they do.
Yeah. Who are we going to call?
All of India.
The whole idea of it is that they want to incentivize people to actually go to a movie theater, which probably leads us into a good conversation of the HDR as well.
Sure. Yeah.
I think that personally, in the cinema, I think that's going to be a real draw, because there was that one story about how Dolby was going to make their own theaters or something like that, or their own... Did you guys see that?
They're trying to do their own branding, like IMAX branding.
Exactly.
Theaters. They want to do Dolby branded theaters. Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense for them as being kind of... They have a name. The name is still incredibly valuable, and people recognize Dolby as a quality brand, like consumers do. So I think that has a certain appeal for them. And also their HDR push has been, I mean, really kind of, I think, pretty well executed, considering that they were the pioneers of it. They were really kind of the ones that were like started the whole movement towards EDR, HDR, whatever you want to call it.
You know, as far as just HDR in general, there needs to be a consensus or some sort of ratification of a standard, because I think there's a couple angles. First, you know, how do we prep for production, you know, in mm-hmm. HDR shooting?
Yep.
And then you've got a situation where, you know, how do we handle it in post, and then how we distribute it? It's not just this idea, oh, we grade with, you know, more values of, you know, black to white. It sort of has implications, you know, because Luma, you know, so to speak, across the entire pipeline is a thing. You know, it's a real foundational thing. And if you change that, all of a sudden, everything must address it. And there's a lot of experimentation, I think, going on. And one of the real things I hope is that they don't add tons of complexity. You know, there's this thought of, oh, we'll have an HDR version for this sort of TV, and then a better TV, and then the really, really good TVs, and they'll sort of activate what they need on their own. You know, it's like, okay, right. Come on now. You know, you've got, not only you've got, you know, the situation where you've got a normal 2D pass, you've got, you know, let's say a 3D pass, but then all of a sudden you have your three HDR grades, each requiring touch-ups. It's like, you know, going to every country in the world with, you know, textless and non-textless and all this stuff.
On a big feature, you're already dealing with, you know, 40, 50, 60, 100 versions of the film, regardless.
Right.
Well, I think all the proposals that I've seen in terms of the HDR encoding specs all have some accounting for the individual display. So that's becoming part of the specification. That's sort of like, that's a big change from where we were in the past with standards, where we were just kind of like, here's the standard and the display will do what the best that it can. In a lot of these new HDR standards, there's some accounting for, there's going to be some differences in performance from display to display to display, which is a good thing, because not all displays are the same. You know, the thing is, fundamentally, I think you're right. We need a unified standard, right? In order for this to take off, it needs to be dead simple for consumers, and it needs to be something that, like, people can just totally understand, like, and HDR as a catchphrase, it ain't gonna cut it. Like, that doesn't mean anything to anyone. Not in the way that 3D actually meant something to people. Like, people understood what 3D was, understood what 3D movies were, even before, like, the new sort of push for 3D came about and 3D in the home came about. And it didn't really register with consumers. They didn't really show that they cared, at least not at home. You know, like, 3D at home never took off, and I think we can safely say it's not going to take off anytime soon. So how do we get people excited, and how do we get the idea of HFR, something that or HDR, something that people don't really have any familiarity with, don't really understand. How do we get people to get excited about it and get into it and actually want to pay extra?
We call it Dolby Vision.
Yeah.
That's a better name than HDR. Yeah.
I think that the one thing that's true, especially about 3D though, is it filtered from the theater experience back to the home experience. So in order to make this actually work, I think they really need to have the cinemas adopt it. Because otherwise, I don't think that if you just start, you know, Netflix just starts airing shows in HDR, I don't think that it's enough. I think that they have to see it in the grand cinema experience, and then it filters down.
Yeah.
The cinemas are all adopted out. I think we used up their adaptation funds a while back. They're still paying off their 3D projectors, and they don't want us to call them for another year or more.
Well, I mean, it's fortunate because a lot of that investment can be repurposed, right? You can there's a lot of 4K projectors, for example, from Barco and Christie that are it's possible to swap out the light engine and put in a laser-based light engine in place of the Xeon lamp. And then all of a sudden, you've got a device that could do HDR.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously not an insignificant investment, but not the cost of a whole new system either.
Yeah.
You have cases like IMAX where you really do have kind of underpowered, like there are no digital projectors that are really sufficient for that size screen at those distances. And so they've been doing things like using two projectors and trying to get around it. And for them, they're going to have to go laser as just the only kind of viable mechanism to get the light output they need at the screen sizes that they need.
Yeah, and laser actually has a wider color gamut as well, doesn't it?
And it also has the lovely side effect of having inconsistent color replication between people.
Yeah, right. It's wider yet narrower, you know.
There's that, yeah.
Yeah. I guess in terms of, you know, things that you guys have been doing in post that you wish were solved, like from a software standpoint, you know, I guess going back toward this idea of, you know, we spoke about Resolve a bit and Avid. When you guys are doing projects now that another year has passed, have you seen, you know, Premiere pop up more or Final Cut 10 or Sony Vegas or, you know, any of these new, you know, have you guys had a hit film project yet?
How did you say Sony Vegas with a straight face?
You can't see me, so. But no, you know, there might be people, you know, experimenting with it because right now it's still a little bit, you know, open. I think that at least we haven't yet declared a winner, although I think we're coming around the bend toward the grandstand, you know. Have you guys had projects coming in on Premiere and other things other than, say, Avid or Final Cut 7?
I mean, I've been working a lot in Premiere. I like it a lot coming from Avid. I know Avid a lot better, and I'm slowly starting to get more integrated into Premiere. There's still a few things. I still don't feel like I have the same precision that I have in Avid, but it's probably just my own lack of knowledge in certain spots, but it's getting close. It's getting really close.
For my sake, we see a lot of projects coming in off a lot of different NLEs, so we see a lot of FCP7 still. We see a lot of Avid. And the one that's been gaining ground has really been Premiere. We don't really see stuff coming in off FCPX at all.
Yeah. Is there a situation where you guys are finding Premiere is finally offering things like a good conform workflow with good XMLs and, you know, the EDLs being standard and things that people were complaining about before? I mean, if there's one feature that I think, you know, Adobe could add to Premiere is just getting in, you know, in line in terms of all the other things that, like, a lot of NLEs like Avid and Final Cut 7 just did really well for a long time.
Yeah, the XMLs have been okay. There's still, like, some sizing issues occasionally. I guess if when we have issues off of XML, it's more often than not because it's coming through Premiere. But those are far fewer, where we used to have to finesse every single XML coming from Premiere. Now it's just once in a while. Yeah. I'll jump into Premiere and change some stuff. Mostly the Premiere gains have been kind of in the independent operator, the lower budget, less established places and editors. So it's kind of the indie software solution, I think.
Yeah, people who are sort of, you know, they sort of champion that idea of just edit what you shot and the non-transcode workflow. And I think a lot of people like that. And, you know, the one thing that's interesting is that if you're going to allow that flexibility going in, there is a place where you sort of editorially have to meet your maker. And I think Adobe would say, hey, you know, just stay here and, you know, use SpeedGrade or stay contained within the Adobe universe and things stay easier. Because really, if you just let people do anything on the way in, if you're going to try to send that off to another application, there's a lot of, you know, ducks to get in a row. And that's a hard thing to pull off for any scenario that may occur, you know, well, if you're trying to test that.
One of the great new features of the last version of Premiere was that they added the ability to transcode codecs. So
right.
you could set up a codec and say make it all ProRes and transcode everything in ProRes, and then you're back into that kind of unified codec space where you don't have all those issues.
In terms of other like color grading apps, have you guys been using any other apps other than, you know, Resolve? Is, you know, for instance, I've tried a number of different apps this year. I had opportunity to learn Nucoda, which has been really cool. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a really nice system because I find that it has like a very, what we'll call, complete looking timeline. I've been using Lustre a lot in the past, and the Lustre timeline is fairly simplistic. It's not, you know, utterly made for editing, although you can, but you step into something like Nucoda and all of a sudden you have a very, you know, Resolve like ability to do editorial changes, and you have plugin support and all sorts of stuff like that. And then you have sure. their take on color tools and things, and it makes for, you know, an interesting option, especially since they, you know, they've lowered their price and they have this nice integration with third party panels and stuff like that. Have you guys, you know, looked at any other color grading tools out there, or find, like, for instance, it could be anything from Baselight to Mystica? I know people are looking at things like Mamba and stuff like that to check out the Mystica world.
I mean, I think you brought up something interesting, which is that this is going to be a big tell year for Nucoda, right? Like, they spent this last year kind of doing a grand experiment of, like, let's drop the price point, let's compete more aggressively, let's straighten up and kind of streamline our product offerings. And I think that this is going to be kind of a show and tell year for them. Like, is this working? Is this something that's sustainable? Are they going to have a new version of Nucoda to show at NAB? Are they going to be announcing any new features? Are they going to be making adjustments to the pricing strategy or to the product lineup? I would be very, very curious to see what they're doing at NAB.
Yeah. I think one of the big things that they're taking care of right now is that, you know, they were largely, you know, a very high-end color tool. And I think one of the things that's nice right now is that they're taking a look at the boutique shops and the, you know, the owner-operators who have to handle sort of whatever may come and have less control of the events that happen before the project gets to them. Mm-hmm. So they've got, you know, a lot of things related to bringing projects in, as well as taking care of things, you know, classically difficult things like how they take care of speed changes, how they take care of things like plugin support and, you know, round tripping between different NLEs. And then the other big thing that I think is going to be important for them is one day to offer Red debayer on the GPU. Yeah. Right now they handle Red nicely, but of course it can be faster. And so it'll be interesting to see if there's any announcements on that front, because as much as Alexa is really popular in a lot of areas of, you know, what we'll call major production, Red is popular everywhere from major production all the way down through indie producers who just got away from DSLRs, you know. So that's a ton of projects out there that, you know, an owner operator would deal with. So I think one of the things that Resolve does really well is it handles that whatever may come scenario. And I think a company like Nucoda, and same thing with Assimilate, if they want to be competitive and offer a really nice value, you've got to allow people to say, look, I can buy your product and deal with whatever kind of customer I get.
Yeah, one thing that I would like to see be a word of the past is round trip. I'd like to see just a one-way path. There's still a lot, like, especially in Resolve, that I don't get from Avid, like paint effects or animat or titles or any of those things, you know, graphics with embedded alphas. There's still a long ways to go with that, but I mean, I would love to just be able to, once you're done.
Wait, are you saying take in graphics with embedded alpha or output graphics with embedded?
No, take in graphics, unless there's a solution to that from an AAF or something like that that's got alphas embedded.
They come in with the embedded alphas now. Like if you bring a PNG or a TIFF or whatever that has embedded alpha.
A QuickTime with an embedded alpha?
Yeah, or QuickTime 444.
I'm going to have to go back and check that out and see. I'm working with DNxHD files. I don't know if that makes any difference.
Oh, yeah, well, that can't support it there.
Okay. Well, then.
But your point is still valid, Josh. This idea that, you know, we can do more in the context of color.
Oh, absolutely.
And then tell people that, you know, this is what it's going to be output, and press the button and give it to them.
Well, I think for a lot of our projects, like, we're not doing round trips anymore. Like, we're mastering out of Resolve, and that's it. That's the end of the day. Like, for features, it's pretty easy to do that viably because a lot of the VFX are being done outside anyway, so they come in as video assets.
You're speaking from like a feature standpoint, though, I guess.
Sure.
What about broadcast episodic? You know, because I think Josh is bringing in you know,
yeah,
these
totally.
Baked
I mean,
I think
the reality series scenario is going to be really tough because you're using there. You know, you're usually using a lot of plugins and there's a lot of kind of transitional elements and things like that that need to be consistent and need to work across the board. And so it's a little bit tougher to see that happening as easily. But you could see it in kind of the narrative broadcast stuff where you could use kind of similar workflows to what you were doing in the feature world, and I could see people mastering and resolve on those projects too.
In terms of the fact that color had sort of a fundamental change where it went from sort of a heavy iron world to, you know, a more computer-based and sort of more accessible world in, say, like, let's say 2008 or 9, where do you think the traditional, you know, heavy iron style, you know, color grading system sit now that we've got several years, you know, in the rearview mirror? So things like Baselite, Mystica, Pablo, you know, even maybe Luster and Flame Premium, you know, what do you think is the situation that they face now as, you know, very expensive systems in a world of very affordable options?
I mean, I think you see a lot of like dedicated color shops trying to differentiate themselves from the kind of the independent practitioners by using Coda, using Baselite, using Luster, not because it's the better tool necessarily, but just because they want to be able to differentiate themselves somehow. I think that ultimately that's kind of self-defeating, right? Like you can only pull that card for so long that, oh, we're not on Resolve, we're on something else. I do see that there's definitely a market for multiple players, and I think Baselite's doing really, really well and kind of adapting really effectively to the changing market, but they definitely knew they needed to adapt, and they've been making strides in trying to adapt and become this kind of end-to-end solution that is really, really flexible and can work inside of a whole ecosystem.
Do you think that they make a Baselite Mac, or do they just keep on with the plugin?
Daylight sort of is a Baselite Mac.
Right, without a timeline.
You know? Yeah, but then you know, if you, like, you've got 4K inside of Avid now, you've got the Baselite Avid plugin, you've got the eyeglass function, which lets you, or spyglass or whatever it's called, which lets you basically apply a timeline effect or a sequence effect in Avid and then have it look for grades for that particular shot from a database. And so you're able to grade in Daylight, do all your looks, and then just apply it on the fly and inside of Avid, and you have total editorial flexibility. Like, that seems like a really nice workflow for a lot of stuff, even for like the reality series, Josh.
Possibly. It still seems a little bit bumpy because of the way that the plugin gets applied. And the issue that I have with it is just references. There's no really good way to reference clips, and getting around the timeline I find is kind of bumpy as well, with the effects applied and where it's, you know, because you're really bringing up several different windows too. So,
well, that's the beauty of, like, in your scenario, right? Let's say you do your look and your grade inside of Daylight, so you're pulling in all the raw footage and doing the looks and then exporting BLG files that are basically just metadata that references the grade, and then your assist can conform the project from the original footage and say apply all the grades that Josh did from these BLG files that correspond to the shots, and it'll automatically apply the grades that you did in Daylight.
Yeah, the only problem with that is I need to see the shots in context. How one shot goes against another, how the whole continuity of
it's,
scenes
it's
go.
Almost like if they would just stick a timeline in that and call it a Baselite, then you'd be all set.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we're always one feature away from greatness.
But I get it. I completely get it, too, because obviously they wouldn't sell any Baselites. Baselite 8, if they decided to just offer a Mac version.
I think Apple has done them a favor in that they are clearly not interested in playing the hardware game, the high-end hardware game, in a way that they've decided, like, we're going to serve these particular sorts of users in the workstation class systems, which is their Mac Pro. And it's a nice box if you're doing what Apple wants you to do on that box, but it's not such a great box when you're outside of that. And I think that the high-end DI falls outside of that, or really color grading falls outside of that.
Yeah, and I wonder if we're going to get some kind of what we'll call group consensus, you know, from the NAB population on, you know, what people think now that the new Mac Pro has been out for a year, and, you know, people have a solid amount of time trying it on with all the things that they need to do. You know, if there'll be a tone about
what do you guys think. What are your impressions? What are your reads on what people think? We're long past the days where Apple exhibited at NAB, but I'm old enough to remember when Apple used to have like a massive giant booth at NAB, and you know, it was often right across the hall from Avid.
Avid, and they would have their little wars,
shouting matches,
presentation
and it was like,
war.
Yeah, and but it was intense, and it was kind of like exciting in that you could feel that there was some energy and some, you know, some activity in that sector.
Well, they cared. There was passion there, and that was fun to think that two companies were fighting over your business, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And companies do fight over our business now, but it just seems like it doesn't have that level of energy and that level of like excitement that it once did. I think, well, in no small part because Apple sort of pulled away from exhibiting, definitely, obviously, because they're not exhibiting anymore. But also, I think, in some ways, from aggressively pursuing that market.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I think the new Mac Pro is a really nice machine for a number of types of people. I mean, if you're an animator or a, you know, even a compositor or somebody doing a multitude of different things from Photoshop to After Effects to Cinema 4D, Nuke, Fusion, well, not Fusion, let's say, because it's not supported yet. But, you know, these applications that will use a really nice 12-core Xeon-based machine and don't need a tremendous amount of I.O. Once you get into a situation where you need high bandwidth I.O. and then you also need lots of video I.O., you know, especially supplementary support for instance, things like GPUs and Resolve or Red Rockets, boy, staying inside the can, as it were, becomes hard.
What do you guys think? I know that they offered a, you know, Resolve Windows that some people are using and it's okay. But what do you think about a Resolve software only or light version on Linux?
That'd be a Juan question. What do you think, Juan?
Linux is such a, you know, people say Linux as if it's like one platform. Mm-hmm. But it's not. It's really right. Like, you know, 380 different platforms, and they're all kind of customized and unique. I think it's a lot of maintenance. I think that's part of the reason why you don't see that many software, entirely software solutions for Linux. You see relatively few of them. I think, what is the editing platform that EditShare owns?
Oh, Lightworks?
Lightworks, the Shark, is the one like serious NLE that runs on, I mean, other than maybe Resolve, that runs on Linux, and it runs on a specific distribution of Linux, and if you want to run it, you run it on that distro. Yeah, so I think it would be a nightmare in terms of support.
Linux doesn't offer creature comforts in the way that Windows and OS X do, and you get in this situation where, on a general level or a daily basis, you have to be willing to do things that most people are not used to, like go into the terminal to do file management and things like that. Mm-hmm. And
or write a script to solve a problem or whatever. It's much more purpose-built, and that also leads to really high performance, right? Like, that's why you get great performance and really high-end, you know, heavy iron stuff. It's all built around Linux, you know, Flame, Resolve Linux, Baselite are built on these
Mystica
Linux platforms.
SUSE
Mystica.
Linux. Mm-hmm.
So because they can customize that OS and that entire environment for that application and get tremendous performance. I mean, Mystica does insane things with the hardware that it's using. But it also means that you have to conform to what they expect you to have and what they want you to have, and that's why you have very tightly controlled hardware requirements for those platforms.
Yeah, and as the world spreads out into the more owner-operator boutique, you know, situation,
then it's like, I got to run Adobe on my box
true.
As well,
yeah,
and
that's
I need to run
point.
This, and I need to run that, yeah.
I just want to get out of the OS X entanglements, like, now you have two GPUs instead of four GPUs, and, you know, when OS updates come out and they take stuff out, I mean...
Well, what I was trying to say before was that I think Apple has sort of done manufacturers something of a favor. You know, companies like FilmLight, with Baselite, they have some ability to then still differentiate. So they can charge $60,000 for a Baselite access or whatever it is, and still sell a $5,000 or $10,000 license for the Mac and differentiate those things, because the Mac is limited to what the Mac hardware is going to allow you to do, whereas the Baselite system is much more robust and able to handle different hardware and do much more scalable things.
Yeah, I think the thing that's nice too is that, you know, if anything, companies are worried about creating offerings that undercut their major primary offerings. You know, it stinks the idea that, you know, you can't innovate or give your customers, you know, something that might be really
choice.
Useful and great, yeah, while, you know, not destroying your balance sheet, you know.
Yeah, but you're seeing less and less of that. I mean, you're seeing Autodesk sort of adapting to it, you know, and figuring out ways to make it work. You're seeing Scratch adapting to it and trying to make it work. I think you see Baselite adapting to it and trying to make it work. So,
in terms of the adapting, one of the big things seems this idea that moving to subscription, you know, a lot of companies that are trying to find a way are trying subscription. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we'll see more companies offering, you know, subscription style pricing as a way to innovate, so to speak?
As a consumer, like, how do you guys feel about subscription products?
I think it's the way of the future, really. I mean, I think that a lot of people are well,
software as a service.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what the other thing too is? Here's the thing that okay, so fundamentally I think subscription is challenging, and I was sort of sympathetic with people that didn't like the idea of not just buying and then keeping it as long as they wanted until they wanted to upgrade. I do feel that that's problematic. But here's the other thing. If I take a hard look back at my prior purchases, you know, for instance, I bought Scratch in the past. You know, I paid for that. And the thing that was difficult is that was a lot of upfront money. And I take a look at how long I used it. And if there was a situation where the subscription had been available to me, given the time that I used it, that would have been a much more affordable proposition. If I think spiritually about it, you know, no, don't like subscription. But if I look at it practically, because of the fact that things change so much, I mean, it's 2015 and 2012 feels like ages ago. You know, that's only 3 years or so. And so you've got this situation where if you put down a lot of money on a system, you know, 3 years is enough of an eternity that probably the context of your prior purchase is completely awash. You know, things are so different now, you know, that you would be faced with another large purchase. And I just find that given the interval now on major purchases, that subscription makes more sense based on this idea. We're not going to even keep it for 2 or 3 years anyway, you know?
Well, I think for some established players in the market, like owners, I think that they feel like the subscription model makes the barrier to entry too low, and it gets a lot of people into their competing against them, sort of competing in their market that wouldn't have otherwise been competing there, because you can just rent it for a year or a month or whatever and do it that way. I don't know if that's, I agree with that, but I do think that I think that subscription as a service for software or software as a service model works well for established mature products that are more maintenance updates. They're not going to be revolutionary updates to the product. You know what I mean? Like After Effects is not going to really change very much. It's a very, very mature product. Premiere is sort of making drastic improvements, but they're nut and bolt improvements. They're not like, let's change the editing paradigm. They're not going to do an FCPX upgrade to that. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that wouldn't work. That model of change of let's just do a 180 and totally change the way we do this, that's not going to fly on a subscription platform. So I think it's sort of, it makes a lot of sense for established software that isn't going to be changing a lot and it's more just maintenance. But it also means that you have to be much more responsive to your customers, right? You can't be upgrading once a year if you're going to be charging people every month. You need to be responding to their immediate needs and doing multiple upgrades a year.
Yeah. And I wonder if people who are doing, for instance, subscription on certain products feel like that's, you know, actually something that has changed. You know, I think maybe that's still settling over time. But, you know, I'll admit one thing that's really wild is just a self-admission. I wanted Premiere and Adobe Media Encoder, so I paid $20 a month for that's what we'll call single application offering. And then I added on Photoshop and Lightroom recently for another $10. Mm-hmm. Man, that $20 to get to just the entire collection is staring me down so hard because I have been recently using my After Effects trial to do some light compositing work. You know, I'm sitting there, I'm like, Adobe, oh, I hate you. You have trapped me.
But, you know? But Fusion is free. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing that kills you.
Well, what I would say is that's completely a fact. And, you know, there are alternatives to Lightroom and, well, I mean, not to Photoshop, but, you know, certainly you could try with one of the,
GIMP. And
yeah. Well, also these new apps, like, you know, I'm just trying to think. You know, there are these new affordable Apple App Store apps out there for photo retouching and stuff. But long story short is that there are applications that I know. They're the path of least resistance. Just it's acquiring them is the only barrier. Right now, that barrier is currently $20. And all of a sudden, I become, you know, fully fledged Adobe subscriber, all while hating myself.
you do get a ton of other software for those $20.
It's like yeah,
you get, you know, you get web design and page layout and Illustrator and all these things.
Audition and all the audio stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some cool stuff in there.
Yeah.
Like the Adobe for $50 a month is a phenomenal value. I have no problem with subscription as a model other than I think it does kind of discourage application developers from thinking of grand ideas. I don't think you can sell a grand idea as a subscription, because $50 a month for the investment it's going to take for a big new application is probably not going to make a ton of sense. If you can't sell, you know, seats at multiple thousands of dollars, then I don't know how you cover the cost of developing a big idea. And with subscriptions, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of development, and you'll see a lot of maybe new offerings coming out. And I think we touched on a bunch of really interesting topics in terms of what's going on heading into this NAB. I think we're going to see coming out of it, I think we're going to see a lot of big surprises and big announcements that maybe we haven't even touched on, and things that we haven't even talked about. I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes out of NAB this year.
Even if you're not going to NAB, you're watching on the sidelines, or, you know, just getting the updates on Twitter, there's going to be a lot. There's going to be a lot going on to keep up with, and news. And so with that, I would like to say I'm Josh Petok. You can contact me at Josh Petok on Twitter, or look up my website, www.joshpetok.com.
And I'm on Salvo. I'm J_Salvo on Twitter. And I'm also available at the Color Space. That's T-H-E-C-O-L-O-U-R space .com. Thanks.
And I'm Jason Myris. You can catch me on Twitter at Jason Myris. You can also check out my website, www.jasonmyris.com. And we'll be posting this episode, as well as chatting about this year's NAB, on LiftGam again. So thanks for listening. Have a great time at the show. And once it's over, I'm sure we'll be talking about all the things that we predicted and see how we did. Thanks.